I worked there. I worked there for so long, so I'm getting sucked into this realm where I could get a little more opportunities to get out and hunt and stuff. But I do miss the people there at those agencies, like state agency, just good people that are doing it for the right reasons, I think. And I miss those opening. My favorite thing was like that opening day of a habitat project. So I'd done, you know, all the project writing, secured all the funding. You know, I've worked with the Forest Service, the BLM. We've got this whole project flagged out, and then you finally get a machine out on the ground, right, whether it's a, you know, a bull hog, or you got a couple of D10 cats with an anchor chain, and you start cutting in that first line, you know, and you can hear those trees being pulled, and you just get that fresh earth smell, you know. That was my very favorite. I love that. I look forward to it every year. But it was a fun job. I really enjoyed it for sure. I have a lot of respect for state game and fish agencies and what you guys do, and you're really the meat and potatoes of giving us a reason why what we can do what we want to do, you know. So we appreciate you stopping by. So we got Mike Scott, Sean Espinoza, they got it right, and then Joe Bennett, and you guys are all from Endow, Nevada Game and Fish, right? Is it fish or just Nevada Department of Wildlife? Aren't you guys, do you have your own fish agency?
No, our fisheries division is just inside of the
Department
agency.
Of Wildlife.
Yep.
Gotcha. Yeah. What brings you guys in town? You're in Vegas today.
Yeah, we're down here for the Wildlife Commission meeting. That'll be tomorrow and the next day. Setting some regulations for migratory birds, and there's a number of other things that are on the agenda, but that's the main thing that's on the agenda.
Gotcha. Are you from Reno then?
In Reno.
Okay. Yeah. Is that where the main office is? Is that Reno?
Yeah, the headquarters office, and we have the Western Region office are both in Reno.
And give us your title.
I'm the Deputy Director of Resources.
Okay. You relatively new to the job, or have you been there for a while?
About 2 years I've been doing that.
Okay.
Prior to that, I was in the Chief of Game position that Sean's in now. And,
gotcha.
You know, and like I said earlier, I was, for the bulk of my career, I was a game biologist down in southeastern Nevada. So.
Gotcha. It's probably a bit of a hard transition, because I know how this works.
Tough.
I've seen it internally, and I know exactly how this flows. This goes from a really fun job in the field to now you're probably pushing a lot of paperwork and attending a lot of meetings.
That's
and
the main thing I do.
Do a lot of public speaking and that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I'm still passionate about it. I still like it. So.
Gotcha. How long have you been with the agency?
35 years.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You don't look old enough to be 35.
Oh, I am. Believe me.
I'd say you fared pretty well then.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Appreciate that.
Gotcha. Sean, what is your job title?
So I'm the game division administrator now and been in the job for about 2 years. Took over after Mike left. And before that, I was the upland game staff specialist for 20 years.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So this is my 29th year with the department.
You got some career vets here. You guys have been in the game a long time.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like it, sometimes it doesn't. You know, it's kind of weird. Just depends on the day, I guess.
Gotcha. And how about you, Joe?
Yeah, now we're going to go in successional stage. I've been with the department about 10 years. Started off as a Tonopah game biologist. I'm based out of Las Vegas here. I was the supervisory game biologist for the southern region until recently, and now I'm the statewide predator staff specialist for the department.
Okay. Man, you guys run the gamut then. So we've got predator and then game and kind of a director of the whole thing. Yeah.
One of them.
Yeah. Gotcha. So do you guys, I'm curious. So you have a commission meeting tomorrow. Do you guys like it? I'm really familiar with the Utah system and how that works. I'm not as familiar with Endow and how you guys' process works, but I assume that you probably have various meetings throughout the year where you address various species, right? So do you have a big game commission meeting at some point where you set tag numbers and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I guess we could just go through the year. So in January, that's generally our season setting meeting. Mm-hmm. Then we have a March meeting that's respected of waterfowl, migratory birds. Then in May, we'll set quotas.
Gotcha.
June will be an upland game meeting. Mm-hmm. And I think in August, is August a fisheries meeting?
Fisheries, yep.
We do fishing regulations in August. And then we'll have a September meeting and a November meeting. So there's seven meetings through the year. Nevada, you know, we have a 9-member wildlife commission.
Okay.
And in Nevada, every county has a what's they call them we call them county wildlife advisory boards, mm-hmm. The CABs. And so each one of those has an advisory board, and we put out recommendations, and then they make, you know, either alternate recommendations or agree with us, and then those decisions go to the Wildlife Commission for the final say.
Gotcha. Is the Wildlife Commission, are they comprised of, I mean, how do they get appointed a commissioner? Is it like a governor appointee?
Okay. Yeah, they're all appointed by the governor.
Okay, gotcha.
They're all on 3-year terms, uh-huh. Or maybe it's a 2-year term, but
three.
A 3-year term.
Yep.
So there's 9 commissioners there, and they're staggered. So each year, they go for 2 terms, but sometimes they go for more. But every year, essentially, you could have 3 that would rotate off.
Gotcha.
A lot of times they decide to stay on. Uh-huh. And so anyway, we've got good wildlife
commission. How do you guys address public input? Because this is something like, I'm really familiar with Utah and the RAC system and how their whole system works and how they take public input and how that goes through, you know, each individual region advisory council, and then they take that to the wildlife board. Do you guys have something similar that public can submit input? Do you have meetings that the people can show up to? And is that how that works? Is it
they
similar?
They show up to the CAB, the county advisory board meetings. Okay. And so generally there'll be a discussion amongst the CAB members first, mm-hmm. about the regulation, and then they open it up for public comment. Gotcha. And then they may elect to come back to us with further questions. If there's something that the public asks and mm-hmm. needs further information from us, then we can address that. Or they take that public comment into consideration when they make their recommendation back to the commission.
Gotcha. Are they fairly well attended? You have pretty popular, is it?
It all depends. It's kind of across the board, mm-hmm. but it does seem to a degree like attendance is waning.
Okay.
In a lot of the rural areas, especially. I think Elko gets quite a bit of attendance just because, you know, it seems to be more sportsman driven in that part of the state. Clark County probably gets pretty good attendance. And strangely enough, Washoe County, where Reno is, it can be variable, but it doesn't get great attendance. And I think that's just a kind of a, you know, because of the issues of the day that folks are facing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they may have kids. Kids play a ton of sports nowadays. Yeah. So there's other things happening. I mean, it's tough for people to, you know, have that flexibility to attend these things. So we get it, but we certainly would like more public input on some of these matters than what we get.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, is just how, I mean, we'll dive into it. You know, I know that we want to talk bighorn sheep. We want to talk kind of what's facing them, what's facing other species in the state of Nevada. I got a whole list of questions that are, you know, related to mule deer management, and elk, and how you guys manage.
we'll take them in order.
And all the things. But, one of the questions is just, and we get asked this question a lot, is like, you know, how can people get more involved in, you know, both conservation and then also just involved in game and fish management? You know, how can they let their voice be heard? And I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying basically you have the meetings, commission meetings, people can show up, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, every county advisory board has meetings people can attend. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, there's 17 of them. 2 of them are pretty inactive from some of the really small counties, but most of the other ones are at least the boards are pretty active, and people can have input there, or they can provide input at the commission meetings. And, gotcha. And you can provide public comment. Mm-hmm. You know, we have an executive assistant that receives a lot of public comment from, you know, all different sources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that all that input goes to the commission. So the commission has sent every one of those comment letters, and they read them.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you encourage non-residents to get involved in Nevada wildlife?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We love non-residents. I mean, truly.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to find out how much.
Yeah. No, I sincerely appreciate the non-residents. You know, they only get 10% of the, mm-hmm. the tags in the state, but they definitely, you know, we have a big following from non-residents, and we sincerely appreciate it.
Yeah.
I guess I'll kind of take it another step forward. So you're talking about people getting involved.
Mm-hmm.
I know we've had you guys out on bighorn captures. There's water developments. Your guys' volunteer efforts help get us to the finish line. All that funding is matched 3-1, and it just helps us get to that next step funding-wise. So mm-hmm. not only do we want people to provide public comment through the commission and cap process, we want to see you guys out there at these programs with us.
Yeah.
Well, and just another thing I would add is we have, in my opinion, we have the best support in the country from the non-government organizations. Yeah. We have sportsmen's groups that are fantastic, whether it's the Fraternity of the Desert Bighorn, Nevada Bighorns Unlimited. There's four chapters of Nevada Bighorns Unlimited. You know, we have absolutely fantastic support from we call them NGOs, but mm-hmm. You know, and that includes a lot of local people. You know, Meadow Valley Wildlife Unlimited, and you know, there's a lot of them, and they're really really supportive of us.
Yeah, groups like what is it, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, has a really good advocacy group for mm-hmm. many issues that, you know, we face on a public lands standpoint here in Nevada, as well as, you know, the rest of the Great Basin, and then National Wildlife Federation. There's a lot of different NGO groups that really are helpful for us, you know, because it's tough for a state agency to mm-hmm. carry the burden of a lot of these issues. You know, we really need advocacy groups out there.
Yeah. Where's the easiest way to find when these public comment things are going to be in Nevada, or when the meetings are going to be? Because I'll admit, even I'm, you know, been a resident here for 11, 12 years now, I don't know if I've seen it at, like, marketed out there enough, or maybe I'm just an uneducated person. I don't know how to, where to find it, but I think I have a hard time when it comes to Nevada, where that is on NDOW's website, or is it through like email, or how could I get?
Yeah, the website's probably the best.
The website's the best, but we do have a dedicated email line. I think it's ndowinfo@ndow.org. And that's a way that people can submit comments, and from anywhere, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, you know, we appreciate the non-residents. And if they have input, we're happy to listen to it. I mean, you know, I know... You know, they are always going to want more tags and things like that, which is fine. But
and, you know, as a resident, I want more tags for non-residents right, too. Right. So it's like I'm a non-resident everywhere else. To understand the frustration.
Under the website, the title lines on across the top kind of can be a little hard to follow, but under the NDOW at work, you go under that and you'll see commission.
Oh, there we go.
And then you just follow that tree down. It'll take you to all the information. Support material, agendas, all that sort of stuff. So
this is the same thing. It's like you just walked me through it. Now I instantly can find it. It's like how we deal with same people when they come to Go Hunt's website. It's like I know how Go Hunt's website works. Like I could look it up in my sleep because I'm on it every single day.
Yep.
Yeah. But other people are always like, it's so confusing. I can't find the information. I'm like, just do this and do this, and it's there. And it's like, yeah, boom. Yeah. Now I found it all. So
yeah.
It's that easy.
Do you maybe we'll switch gears and kind of dive in, but. Are you ready to switch gears and dive in?
Yeah.
Okay. Give us like a rundown of where we're at in Nevada, state of Nevada, as far as populations, health of herds. And we can take it from species standpoints. We can start with bighorn sheep because we kind of already brought it up and kind of, I know that you guys are facing some concerns. Maybe talk your way through those and where we're at. And then maybe we'll dive into some of the other more charismatic species like elk, right, Brady?
Yeah, so.
Elk, mule deer.
You bet.
Pronghorn.
I could start off with desert bighorn sheep and what we're living down south here. So you guys live down here. You know, we haven't gotten much moisture over the last 8 months or so. We have been monitoring guzzlers, man-made water developments through summer, early fall months. We started getting into December, realizing that we had quite a few that were critically low. Normally, if you go through the annual rainfall pattern of the Mojave Desert, you know, you start getting rainfall in November. I'm going to start there. That causes some vegetative green up, allows some sheep to move off those water developments. And then you get into from about then till now, where we should get most of our moisture. And we have remote water monitoring systems out. I'll go through, and as Mike alluded to, that wouldn't be possible without our NGO communities, the Fraternity of Desert Bighorn Wild Sheep Foundation, and Wynn helped with providing the funding for those. So we have about 25 of those systems out. So even the moisture that we received, say, February 14th and then last night, mm-hmm. we maybe got between 0.2 of an inch of rain to 1 inch of rain in some of these mountain ranges. And our standard collection system or apron down here, 1 inch of rain gives you about 2,000 gallons on a 40 by 80 foot system, just to put it in reference. So as you guys know, we had record-breaking temperature in July, 120 degrees, multiple mm-hmm. days. Then it was 100 degrees in October.
Yeah,
and then we got to November, and we still realized, gosh, these sheep just haven't moved off these water developments like they would on a normal year. So then we got to right around Christmas time. We put together an emergency water haul. We hauled water to 10 different guzzlers and 6 different mountain ranges that were, if not dry, close to dry. But obviously with the cooler temperatures, these sheep are a little more resilient. So I think we caught it in time. And then so we hauled 37,500 gallons in, and then we just kept waiting for rain, and it just didn't happen. So then once it got to about the end of January, going into February, as we start getting through that annual cycle of rainfall, we identified a much larger effort that needed to be done. And that's about 27 projects in 12 different mountain ranges. We started that effort a couple weeks ago. So this most recent effort, we've hauled to 12 projects in 6 different mountain ranges and about 60,000 gallons of water, and we're probably about 50% there of what we're going to do. I'll go through a little bit of a breakdown. As you can imagine, aerial water hauls, they're not cheap.
So you're hauling it with a helicopter?
Correct.
Yeah, these are remote. Like, you flew these guzzlers in and built them.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Are they like the large apron style with like a... like a plastic sheet down that holds it down, or are they corrugated?
Think about like a metal roof without the slope. Yeah.
Yep, gotcha.
And then you just have enough slope that goes to a gutter, and that's HDP or hard line to tanks, and then self leveling. That's what most of our systems are now.
Gotcha.
We still have a few slick rocks and and float valve systems with moving parts, but as a whole, mostly they're the first system I mentioned. So yeah, we're doing these. They're remote. It's with the helicopter. Like for the Muddy Mountains, for example, Valley of Fire State Park, Unit 268, we identified this problem when we had extreme drought conditions in 2020. We probably hauled there 5 or 6 times since 2020. And then we started to change our strategy of how we provide water on the landscape for these species or for bighorn sheep. So we're like, we worked with Valley of Fire to get a system to where we could just turn on a valve. Then we have a couple tanks on the west entrance that we could just haul with a truck, and then the new White Basin project on the southeast side is we can drive to it. So it just takes time, but we're trying to work a strategy to where we don't have to do these very costly strain on staff water hauls. I guess kind of circling back to that rainfall pattern, and then I'll kind of get into what the next steps are. So, you know, if we don't receive rain by now, you're probably not getting a whole lot of rain until the monsoon season.
Yeah.
And we didn't get any monsoon season last year. Hardly at all either. So we're just kind of in this vicious cycle, and we're providing water, and that's one part of the equation. But as you don't have any water on the landscape, you don't have the vegetative forage. You're not getting that green up. Those plants aren't green and succulent. They take more water to break down. Because think about, like, I always use this analogy, go eat 6 crackers without an ounce of water and see what, I know it sounds terrible, but that's the analogy I've been using. So everything on that system takes more water. And then so with it being warmer, them sheep have to go to the guzzlers earlier in the year. They're not getting that water from the vegetation. They're staying there longer, and they're pretty much been there year round this year because of the drought cycle we've encountered. So with that being said, and Mike mentioned this, we wouldn't be able to do this without our partners. Like, we have, and I don't know how much you want to get into details on the funding aspects, but just to break down a water haul day, it's $10,000 to $15,000 a day to conduct these water hauls when you factor in $1,000 an hour for the helicopter, you're renting equipment, you got personnel, staff, you've got just the whole equation. And then another part of this equation that I'm going to get into in a minute are bighorn sheep translocations that we're going to have to do because of these drought conditions. We got to get some mouse off the landscape. So we're going to be doing those water hauls, finishing up between now and probably mid-April before it gets too warm. These guzzlers aren't dry right now, so we got a little time. But when you factor in we're doing 27 projects, probably 25 to 30 days of work. It takes about a day to do a project. I mean, you're looking at well over $400,000 just in aerial water hauls, excluding the effort we did in December. So we've worked through our subcommittee of the commission with the principal wildlife heritage account. We have a pending ask of $500,000 there that'll be discussed this weekend. Kuyu and Ovis Grand Slam graciously gave us $250,000. Nevada Bighorns Unlimited and Reno gave us $100,000. The Fraternity of Desert Bighorn, $100,000. And then we...
Dream Tag.
Then we have $100,000 with Dream Tag. Gotcha. And then we have a whole lot of smaller NGOs, such as Wildlife Habitat Improvement in Nevada, Elko Bighorns Unlimited, Fallon Bighorns Unlimited that have been tapped as well, that we're waiting on commitments for, along with the Wild Sheep Foundation. So just talking about the guzzlers, you know, you're looking at probably $500,000. Mm-hmm. And then I'll get into, you know, we're hauling water, and then we're going to the Muddies and Blacks bighorn sheep populations are bacterial pneumonia free or MOV free. Mm-hmm. They don't have disease. So
haven't had ever?
They have not been exposed. They're kind of our diamond in the rough.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Wow.
With that being said, though, when we conducted aerial survey in there last year, just in the Muddies alone, we classified 442 sheep with a lamb representation of 42. That's indicative of an increasing population.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got the perfect storm here of limited water, mm-hmm. limited vegetation, and then now you're going into this drought cycle with no green up. Like, you can provide as much free water as you want, mm-hmm. but it's eventually going to reach a carrying capacity threshold.
Yeah.
Right. So we're evaluating a lot of outlets for those sheep, such as the state of Utah, the nursery herd, which I'm sure you guys have discussed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the Cortez Mountains, but that's obviously dependent on NEPA compliance or Land Management Agency compliance. And then we're also looking at other populations in the more central part of the state, such as Hunt Unit 183, the Clan Alpines, 182, the Stillwaters, 045, the Tobins, 202, the Wasik Range. And that's all going to occur this June. So we're going to be doing pre-sampling in all these herds, mm-hmm. just to make sure they're disease-free for right. outlets. But all of those translocations will happen this June.
This is kind of worst-case scenario then, right? Like, you're at a point where you've got no moisture, no vegetation to support the population. So, I mean, if a miracle happened and we somehow got rain, is that population still, like, does it have room to expand still? It's not a carrying, I mean, it's carrying capacity for what you've been given right now. But if you had a normal annual cycle of moisture, do you have room to grow sheep there? Or are you at a point where you're like, yeah, it's time to move some off?
I'm going to be honest. I don't want that population to expand further than it is now, because
sure.
we're realizing when times are good, we'll mm-hmm. have a couple good years, and then 3 out of 5 years are bad years.
Huh.
So I'd rather, since it is disease-free, knowing it's going to have good lamb representation, I would rather supplement some of these other herds mm-hmm. where they can grow, where they were hit with disease maybe 5-7 years ago, but now we determine aren't actively shedding bacterial pneumonia, and then let those populations grow back to what they were.
Gotcha.
In the absence of disease, essentially.
So how many sheep are you looking to move then?
I think it's safe to say we're looking to move 150 sheep out of the Muddies.
Okay.
That's a pile of sheep.
Because I want to manage it below that carrying capacity, below sure. that water and forage resource limitation.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be constantly up against it, because then you're just in this vicious cycle.
Right. Does it seem to be the case? I mean, historically, if you look back in time and seeing droughts of this nature, is this like an anomaly, or is this, I mean, do you think we could return, or is this kind of the new norm?
I don't think it's getting cooler and wetter out
there. It's not getting cooler and wetter.
Yeah.
I think it's the new norm. We're trying to learn how to manage bighorn sheep with disease. Right. And, you know, Joe mentioned a lot of it, and Joe's been intimately familiar with it for quite a number of years now. But basically, it puts us in a difficult spot when we have clean sheep that we need to move, because you don't want to move them in with sheep that have disease, and vice versa. You can't take, you know, any sick sheep and move them just anywhere. So it does limit our options for where we can move them. And at least where we can safely move them. Gotcha. And so, you know, we struggle with that a little bit, but we do have some really good personnel that are working on it, veterinarians and researchers and staff that are and NGOs that are a big part of that. So
yeah, we probably should have brought a map for you guys and even somehow displayed it for the viewers to look at that strain type map for Mycoplasma ovipneumonia across the landscape. We only have probably 2, maybe 3 herds across the entire state, excluding California bighorn, that have not been exposed to some form of mycoplasma.
If you want to send that, I can definitely we can pop it on the screen right now while we're talking a little bit.
Yeah, so we just updated it, so it's valuable.
What is it about those areas that has been able to retain that disease-free status? Is it, I mean, have you guys like eliminated domestics, you know, in the areas, or there? I mean, what is it about that area that remains disease free?
I don't know how we. How do you explain the muddies?
I think I can explain it pretty well. So when you think about like the closest domestic sheep trailing allotment to southern Nevada, you're a couple hundred miles.
Okay.
So a lot of our movement is like leapfrogging from bighorn sheep to bighorn sheep. Say you got a ram during the rut that's dispersing. Mm-hmm. Just something like that's happening from population to population. I think the saving grace for the muddies and blacks is just the natural barriers that you have around it. You have Lake Mead, you have I-15 to the south, you've got Lake Las Vegas in that corridor. That's the only way I can explain
it. So it's just kind of geographically isolated.
Yeah, knock on wood. It's going to continue to be our gem, but it could be a matter of when.
Right.
Like,
I don't know a little bit, but maybe give listeners an idea of pneumonia in sheep. How long has it existed? Is there any cure for it? How do you manage a sheep population that has pneumonia that runs through it?
That's a pretty difficult question, but I'll do my best to answer it. So we have been able to test for it about the last 15 years, from my understanding. And in the state of Nevada, we're dealing with about 15 different strain types of bacterial pneumonia. And you have some populations with multiple strain types. So managing in the presence of disease with a wild population is very difficult.
Sorry if I stop you real quick, but when you first started testing 15 years ago, did you find it present when you first started testing? Or did you start testing because you were observing sheep that were sick?
Yeah, so we've had a number of die-offs. You know, honestly, we've had die-offs going back many decades. Gotcha. And that was probably what actually brought down populations in the late 1800s when, you know, by different, different reports from back then, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of desert bighorns or any bighorns in the state. And, you know, domestic livestock, they basically evolved with disease, and they aren't affected by it, but they do carry it. And, you know, that was probably where it was introduced. But as Joe mentioned, now we have situations where bighorns that have been exposed are carrying it. You know, a young ram that wants to rut somewhere else, they'll just travel. And so now it's really in bighorn populations, and they can move just about anywhere.
From what I understand, it was first documented in North America in 1972. So it's been around for 50 plus years.
Gotcha.
It was first, I guess, isolated and identified worldwide in Scotland in 1963. Now, how long it was present on the landscape before it was isolated and identified, you know, right. Who knows? But the problem seems to be is you know, it's got a lot of heterogeneity, so it kind of it moves around a lot, and mm-hmm. it's sort of like, you know, I guess you could see it's kind of like COVID.
Changes.
You know, is there a COVID 18, 19, 20? Yeah. So right. trying to vaccinate for it on a movie, it's like trying to vaccinate a moving target.
It's like getting the flu shot, right? You get the flu shot, you get it for a specific strain that they think is going to be the most prevalent in the population that year, and it may or may not be. And you might still get the flu of a different strain, right?
Exactly.
Is there a natural immunity? Like, do they develop any kind of natural immunity in sheep to this?
So it just depends on the strain type, what I've seen in these populations. Some strain types, like, I'll get to a few other populations. I know we were talking about the Muddies, but we're also looking at the Arrow Canyon Range, Hunt Unit 244, and then the McCullough Range, Unit 263, just south of town here. So Unit 263 is very tough. Like, they're limited by water and vegetation resources, but they have the highly virulent Mojave strain of bacterial pneumonia, which has devastating effects throughout the whole population, you know, from adults to young, where some of the less virulent strains, such as Southern Nevada or NTTR, for example, may have a couple years of poor lamb production, but then you start to see them bounce back. But then you might have 4 or 5 good years and then a new strain getting mixed in there. And then that both those strains combine, then now the whole herd is just upside down. So it's a difficult thing to manage bighorn sheep in the presence of disease. I mean, we tried test and remove in some areas, but unless you have a population where you can limit that movement in and out, that ingress, egress, it's very difficult to try to completely eradicate disease out of the population. Because what you have is you'll have a disease event, then the prevalence rate's real high. You know, 70-80% of the sheep have been exposed. Then as you get 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years past it, that prevalence rate may be less than 5%. So trying to find the individual that is actively shedding that bacterial pneumonia is like a needle in a haystack.
Right.
So that's why it's very difficult to manage in the presence of disease.
Mm-hmm.
We see certain indicators like lamb recruitment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Once that starts to increase, then we think, well, things might be getting better. Gotcha. And you'll see sometimes lamb recruitment go from the teens into the 20s, and then maybe you have, you know, 41, 42, and then you're like, well, maybe it's recovering.
What would be a high lamb ratio?
So with
like on a growing herd,
all of our big game populations, if you're low to mid 30s, you're maintaining to slightly increasing. If you get up in those upper 30s, 40s, you're increasing. So when we do, like, it's different for each population that or each species that we manage. Like deer, we look at our spring to, you know, our fawn per 100 adults, whereas sheep, we're looking at our lamb to ewe ratio because we fly in September. So if you're like the Muddies, for example, if you get above 40, you're increasing at a pretty good rate.
Have you seen rates like that? I mean, that high?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Seeing it.
Not entirely uncommon, then.
No, I think about every population that we're evaluating to translocate to has lamb ratios above that 40 mark right now.
So, I mean, there's good news, right, in that. Like, you have populations that are growing. It's just tough drought.
Yeah, you know, we had two pretty good wet years in a row, and that's what tends to drive those lamb ratios or fawn ratios.
Mother Nature, she's queen.
Very helpful. Very helpful.
Yeah, you can. We've talked about it a bunch, but you can do. I mean, it's so hard with disease. You know, you talk about habitat and habitat restoration. You can do just about everything you can think of, but really, Mother Nature just holds the cards, and she kind of dictates things on whether they're going to be up or down. Or, I just wish we could figure out how to get a little bit better moisture cooperation from Mother Nature. Pray to figure that out.
I hope so. I was actually doing, like, my girlfriend texted me when we were up at the Hunt Expo over Valentine's Day. She's like, oh, it's raining in Vegas. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you. Like, we needed it so badly. So I was doing an extra rain dance when I was up there, and that's why it's rained the last couple of days here finally. So I was trying to help. I'm going to bring this up. Didn't really want to, but I'll bring it up. I was reading the Nevada Bighorn Sheep Working Group documents, and I did see something in there about potential for emergency hunts.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a very extreme case that we might get to later on? Can you throw that into like more tags for sheep coming up during the draw? Or is that like emergency, like outside a normal hunting season for some of these populations that might not be able to move?
Well, so we could use hunting as a means to reduce this population. And we will likely increase a few ram tags in the muddies, possibly some of these other ranges. The muddies still has a ewe hunt, and so we could increase a few tags there. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about an emergency hunt, that would be the absolute last resort.
That's what I figured.
That is absolutely something we do not want to do. Mm-hmm. But I would rather see people put them in their freezers than see them die of thirst out on the landscape or starve to death. Mm-hmm. So it's again, that's not something that we're gonna try to do. But we do have that option if mm-hmm. it ever came down to it.
Can we do anything on the habitat side, or is it just again Mother Nature? We need a lot of rainfall to grow some vegetation out there.
Well, it depends on where you're at in the state, but down here, it's really, really reliant on Mother Nature, and you know, precip is mm-hmm. is at a premium, and so when you do have good precip, you know that you tend to have the groceries on the landscape. In other parts of the state, you know, we do a lot of habitat manipulation, mm-hmm. Whether it's fire rehab or pinyon juniper removal, things like that. And you know, we have a lot of partners that work with us on those, land management agencies and NGOs that do a lot of work. And we can get into it at some point, but we do a lot of habitat work.
Oh yeah, I remember last time we were down here, we were talking about all the habitat work that Nevada does, and it's a lot.
Yeah, what does it cost to move a sheep?
Yeah, so I can give you that breakdown as well. Yeah.
Nice estimate on that.
So when you were talking about a project, you were talking about the project of moving water, right? You're hauling water to a guzzler, but then when you get to the point where you're like, yeah, this is critical mass, like we have to do something, we're going to move sheep. That cost is above and beyond what you're talking, the $500,000, right, which you need for hauling water.
Correct. So I can give you that translocation breakdown of what we're anticipating as well. We're looking at almost $1 million project once this is all said and done, when you factor in everything. That's why we went out to all these NGOs, all these principal accounts, donation accounts, tag accounts, specialty tag accounts. So just to capture sheep, you're looking at about $1,200.
Per sheep.
And then you're for collars, because some of this is going to be a little experimental. You want to mm-hmm. know where they go. You want to know that they're not being infected with disease, so on and so forth. You're looking at about between $1,200 and $1,800 per collar. Also, to be responsible in a lot of these populations, you need to do some pre-sampling of those like 13-month-old lambs, because in theory, if they're not exposed, then they're not interacting with the chronic shedder on the landscape. You're looking at probably another $50,000 there, you know, $1,200 per sheep once you factor in all these populations. I mean, and then you have staff and personnel time, mm-hmm. you have sampling costs. It's not a cheap endeavor.
So you're looking at about $1 million?
For both projects, I would say, and yeah.
Where does that money come from?
So as I mentioned earlier, we asked our principal heritage account for $500,000. The Dream Tag's given $100,000. Okay. Nevada Bighorn Unlimited's $100,000. QU Ovis Grand Slam's $250,000. Fraternities $100,000. Then we have a bunch of smaller NGOs contributing anywhere between $10,000 and $25,000. Then another component to all this that I think our listeners will inquire about is that you don't want to put naive sheep where they're just going to get potentially killed by a lion. Mm-hmm. So it's in our big game release plan to do pre and post treatment of those areas. So go out there, do a search, see if there's any lions on the landscape, just so you want to give them the best chance to survive.
Yeah. Can you do anything with Nevada Heritage, you know, governor's type tag funds that we, you know, get every single year? Tags are going for a lot of money, because I know it's a hot topic in some states lately about, you know, where's all that money going to? Can you use that for things like this? Or
so our commission's going to be voting on it this weekend of that $500,000 principal ask, and that's directly from the funding of those heritage tags.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that's good.
Yeah, that's real good.
Does any part of this come from just the general funding of hunting licenses? So you got to buy a hunting license in order to apply in Nevada. Does any of that money go back into a project like this?
We have Pittman Robertson funding through our grant programs. Mm-hmm. Most of that funding has already been used up for some of the projects we had already planned to do. There was some work that we did with mountain goats earlier this year from Utah. We moved 16 mountain goats from Utah into the East Humboldt Range. There was also another project in Oregon where we moved 40 bighorn, California bighorn, from Oregon to northwestern Nevada. A lot of that was funded with NGO funding as well, because we tried to, you know, reduce as much as possible the hit on the federal aid grant. Salaries and things like that have gone up, so we got to absorb that within the grant to some degree. So we had to use quite a bit of heritage money that was granted the previous year, plus some of the NGO funding that we had before. But we wouldn't have enough in the grant to cover an effort like this.
Gotcha.
You know, just thinking of this from a temporal standpoint, you know, just 3.5 months ago, we didn't think we would be in this situation.
Yeah, yeah. Comes fast,
so
doesn't it?
It comes really fast.
Really,
I mean, we were doing this a couple days after Christmas. We had Joe out there, you know, foregoing any annual leave time to go out there and run around and try and figure out what water developments need to be filled at what time. And, you know, we put that together pretty quickly, and we thought, well, you know, in the next month, January, we might get some rain and things will turn around. And
is there a means of just the public to donate? Is there like any kind of fund that somebody can just donate to that you're aware of?
I guess they could do that. We don't have any just natural mechanism for people to donate. So, but you got me thinking now that maybe there might be an opportunity, because I think there are a lot of people that aren't hunters or sportsmen that do care about wildlife and would probably be interested in helping out.
Yeah, and you may have hunters and sportsmen that aren't necessarily donating to, you know, buy tickets for dream tags or, you know, contributing to an NGO that would then, you know, turn money over to you. I mean, they may want to donate $5 or $10 and just, you know, help out where they can. I don't know. The other thing that had me thinking, the reason I asked about the sale of licenses is, I mean, you guys' draw is still coming up. You know, you have to buy a hunting license for a non-resident. I think it's $160. Is that right? You know, and I talk to people all the time. I always tell people, you know, Nevada's a state where you kind of have to make a value cost judgment, right? You have to look at what you want to hunt and kind of decide, as a non-resident, I'm a non-resident in Nevada, you know, if it makes sense for you to apply based on your draw odds and your objectives. And, you know, I think that it is, and I'll ask you guys here in a minute if you think that it is for a non-resident. I'd be interested in hearing your take on it. But, you know, maybe it's just an opportunity for people, and Lorenzo says it all the time, you know, we all look at buying a hunting license or a permit as like, here's this opportunity for me to get something, like I get to go hunting. But he often says, you know, look at it as like a donation for the benefit of wildlife as a whole. You know, like, it's $160. It's an opportunity for you, whether you get a draw tag or not, or you maybe you won't go hunt small game or predator. But maybe you could just donate, buy a license, you know, just to donate back to wildlife in general. So that was the other reason I asked, is if increased applications would help you secure more money for this type of project.
Yeah, it always does. I mean, we do have a pretty good following of both residents and non-residents. And, you know, every year it seems like our applications continue to increase. And, you know, we did see like the COVID bump, you know, where everybody wanted to get outside and everything. But now things are starting to wane a little bit. And with respect to some of the PR funding, the Pittman Robertson and Dingle Johnson funding. But, you know, people are still, you know, people are still interested in hunting in Nevada, and you know, we provide a pretty good product. We don't have the numbers, but we do have the quality, and so I think a lot of people are still interested in hunting in Nevada, and it is a great value. You know, anybody that buys a hunting license in Nevada, if they came to Nevada and didn't bring their shotgun last year, that was a mistake. Because we had I'll let Sean talk about this, but we had a phenomenal year for Upland Game.
I drew a deer tag. Was it not last year? The year before? I guess I did draw a tag last year.
2 years in a row.
2 years in a row. I drew a deer tag, but I drew a deer tag in Northwest Nevada, and there were a lot of days where I was thinking, I wish I was just hunting you know, upland game. I mean, I was seeing a lot of deer, don't get me wrong. I wasn't necessarily seeing, you know, the buck that I was like dreaming of, but man, I saw so much upland game. And I remember thinking at the time, like, because I got a 12-year-old boy, he wanted a shotgun last Christmas, so he got a shotgun. But I remember thinking, I'm gonna mark this and keep it in the back of my mind and maybe run up sometime, because they were awesome. I mean, chuckers all over.
Yeah.
And then throwing the opposite of that, my brother drew one of the, you know, highly coveted Nevada non-resident elk tags this year. And he's always asked me, like, why do I keep applying in Nevada? You always hear people aren't drawing. I'm like, well, you always have a chance.
Yeah.
You know, he had 0.09% odds, but he still drew.
Wow.
And had a phenomenal hunt, took a giant bull. Yeah. But I want to go back to, like, how maybe people can help. Because I was recently looking this up too, and it's like, maybe I urge all residents to do this, but like, a lot of people here at the office, I have a Nevada Bighorns Unlimited license plate on my truck. Mm-hmm. And I actually looked up how much money they actually do every single year on that. And for not doing that, like, that money I looked does go directly to wildlife. I was trying to make sure it doesn't go to like other things I don't support, but obviously Nevada Bighorns Unlimited support them all in general, so I know it's going to go somewhere good, but I like that it actually does go to wildlife. Mm-hmm. So if you're a resident of Nevada, it's not that hard to switch your license plate. Sure, it's expensive, but you can do it. Then every single year, I know I'm actually donating slightly, you know, to something that I care about, in addition to, you know, hunting licenses and all that stuff in the state. So I thought, yeah, that was really cool when I looked it up.
And well, you get a cool license plate.
And it's a cool license plate, too. It actually does.
It is a cool license plate.
The three sheep on there, pretty baller. Yeah.
So, you know, on our website, or, you know, when you do apply, you can buy what's called resource enhancement stamp. Yeah. You can, okay, you can donate to that. And the other thing that you can donate to is our junior license fund. And, you know, just really quick, we have the opportunity in Nevada where juniors basically get a free hunting or fishing license. For it to be a hunting license, they have to qualify and, you know, go through hunter safety, but they can get a free license, and that's all donated money from other sportsmen, other places where we, you know, new people that come into the sport, they can get a free license, you know, under mm-hmm. 18, under 17. Mm-hmm. And one of the really cool things about that is I believe it's about 65% of those people are novel. They're brand new people into the sport. So it's a really cool program. It's one of we have a young man working for us that it's Bobby Jones. It's his brainchild, and it's going to change things in Nevada. And it's definitely changed things for a lot of young people, because they can actually hunt and fish for free.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Last year, I can't remember what time you guys were down here, but we talked about that, and I was like blown away with that project. It's like, oh, that's a really, really cool idea.
Yeah. Generally speaking, I mean, it sounds like we have a problem. Drought, obviously, or lacking water, but it sounds like you got a plan in place, and provided you can get the money to move these sheep, I mean, you'll move them to populations and areas where you think they'll do okay. Generally speaking, sheep, though, I mean, your populations are doing good, right? Would you say? Or are they...
Well, anybody who's looked at the population estimate that we published over the last 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. I think it went statewide from about 12,000 to 7,000.
Oh, wow.
It's okay. I mean, we had the worst drought in 1,000 years in 2020. Mm-hmm. Like, it was the worst day of my career when we were doing aerial surveys and we saw sheep dead at water developments in the Muddy Mountains, Muddy Mountains. I don't ever want to see that again. I'll haul water any day of the week mm-hmm. before I see that again. And if we have the opportunity to help other populations, I see this as a success that we have this many sheep on the landscape. Mm. And it's a product that we cost from the way we managed sheep in the 80s, 90s till now. I mean, we have the most sheep in the lower 48. So we do have a problem. I feel like we're addressing it adequately. I don't think there's any reason to think there's going to be a funding limitation at this point. You keep mentioning how people can help. There's going to be plenty of volunteer opportunities. I'll keep moving back to that. If you want to come haul water, give me a call. I will gladly have you come help me.
We'll put you to work.
Yeah, if you want to come on a bighorn sheep capture, it's going to be exciting times come June. I mean, this is going to be one of our largest efforts that we've probably done in the last 10 or 15 years. Okay.
I know some of the guys that go hunted out there recently. I saw Norris was out there.
Yeah. You'll have to pencil us in. We'll have to try to get a group together and come and do a few days. That'd be awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, those are fun. I got to take my kids on a couple mountain goat translocations when I worked for Game and Fish, and it was like they still talk about it. You know, getting to see a mountain goat being lowered down the helicopter, you know, and they get to walk up and kind of feel their hooves and, you know, check out. I mean, when would you ever get a chance to really be close to an animal like that? So
pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. What about deer and elk? How are they doing? Pronghorn.
So actually our pronghorn are doing awesome in most places of the state.
Really?
Yeah, we've got, you know, there's sort of a two sides of the coin here, two sides of the piece of the state. Northern Nevada is doing fairly well precipitation wise. There's sort of a line that you can draw somewhere around Nye County over into northern Lincoln County where it kind of shuts off, unfortunately. A lot of that moisture has come in the form of rain, so our snowpack is a little lacking. So springs and streams in a lot of places might suffer come this summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still got a month and a half left to go of what we think of might be winter. So we're already seeing that in the north. You know, it just rained yesterday for most of the day.
Yeah, it was snowing in Cedar when I left this morning.
Yeah, and we flew down today, looked down around Goldfield, and it was a blanket of white. So there's some pretty decent coverage, I think, that's come on here. So the northern portion of the state is holding its own, and pronghorn in particular are doing really well, particularly in the northeastern portion of the state. We even looked at maybe it's time that we should start thinking about moving pronghorn to other depauperate areas of the state and try and bolster those populations. But places where we thought about moving them to, they're in that drought condition, and we're like, well, I don't want to put them somewhere
where they're going to struggle. Gonna,
yeah, yeah. So that's what we're faced with there. Deer, we've seen at least, you know, I guess you could call it a short-term recovery. We were in a bad spot here basically 2 years ago with the winter that we had. We had a long-term drought. I think 2018-19 were some of the most horrible years of drought that I've ever seen in northwestern Nevada. You could walk by a sagebrush bush in northwestern Nevada and it would just fall apart, you know, with barely even touching it. So it was in pretty bad shape. And then we followed that by a pretty hard winter not too long thereafter. And so deer that were on winter range were suffering pretty good, not only from the snowpack that we had, but also because of the where they went to go winter had succumbed to previous drought. So it was a pretty tough situation for them. But here recently we've seen better survival, and we've seen better fawn recruitment than we've seen in quite some time. So I think we're in a better place, certainly from that standpoint. Elk, they're pretty resilient. They've been doing good. We're faced with a little bit of drought right now in White Pine County. So, you know, there's not too much to worry about with elk right now.
Gotcha.
So we're feeling
they're pretty
good.
Hardy.
Yeah. They'll eat the generalist, right? Eat about anything. Yeah. And they move to find, find food.
I'm just going to go back to deer real quick.
Yeah, I want to go back to deer.
You know, over the last 30 years or so, we've lost half of the sagebrush in the state of Nevada, and you've seen our deer populations have plummeted because of that. It's mainly winter range issues, but it's a lot of other issues as well. But sage grouse, you know, being reliant on sagebrush, we've seen them drop just like that. And you know, that period from basically around the year 2000 to about 2022, somewhere in there, that 20-year period, I believe it was the driest 20-year period in 12 centuries, I think is you know. So, I mean, when you're trying to increase wildlife and you get one good wet year and then three or four drought years, it makes it pretty challenging. There's, you know, we talk about Mother Nature, and there's a lot of things that we can do for you know, habitat. We can do predator control, you know, things like this. But Mother Nature really dictates what happens out there on the landscape. Yeah. So
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because you know, I spent most of my career working on greater sage grouse. Mm-hmm. And we have a graph. It's a pretty interesting graph when you look at it. It's a long-term graph of fawns per 100 does and productivity of sage grouse. chicks per hen values mm-hmm. that we get from analyzing the wings on an annual basis. If you look at the correlation between those two metrics on over time, it's at the same downward trajectory.
Mirrors
each other very closely. They're both sagebrush obligates in the Great Basin, mm-hmm. and it goes back to primary productivity. And if you don't have good primary productivity, you just don't generate recruitment mm-hmm. like you should for either one of those populations. So,
is it mostly drought related? Is it Pinnaney juniper expansion? Combination of both?
A lot of the sagebrush loss is attributed to wildfire.
Okay,
That's been a big part of it. At least in the northern part of the state, up in that I-80 corridor, that's where that's mostly been affected by wildfire. You get into central Nevada, northern Lincoln County, White Pine County, eastern Nye County. We do have a ton of PJ expansion, and you know it continues to. If you look at some of the aerial photos from like the mm-hmm. 1930s, there was trees there, but they were pretty sparse. And over time, you see that they've gone up in elevation, they've gone down into the valleys, lower elevation, but they've also gotten much more dense. Mm-hmm. And there's just nothing that really, there's no understory underneath a lot of that dense PJ. And it's fine for thermal cover. Mm-hmm. And in some of the years when you have a good pine nut crop, everything uses those. I've seen coyotes, you know, deer eat pine nuts. Everything eats pine nuts when you have those good years. But those years don't come often enough to for it to be of enough value.
Gotcha.
So yeah, we do PJ clearance, we do fire rehab, and you know, we're trying to as much as we can do. We're not keeping up with the expansion of PJ.
Sure.
Then we have everybody's favorite elephant in the room, and that's the number of wild horses and burros on the landscape.
I was going to get that.
Yeah. Literally, I just touched the mic a couple seconds ago.
Glad you jumped on that.
I don't think it's an elephant.
I will say that I do appreciate, I think it's the last couple of years it's been in there, but maybe it hasn't. Maybe it was like 2 years ago, but the Nevada Big Game Status Book, you actually put a little graphic in there about amount of feral horses and burros biomass compared to native ungulates in the state. And you read that, you look at that graphic, and that's alarming.
Mm-hmm.
It's like literally, I think it was 3-1.
What are your thoughts?
I mean,
what do we do?
Well, there was a report that came out with respect to how to handle it. And you really have to, at least initially, you have to allow the BLM to have the budget capacity to gather down to the lower end of mm-hmm. AML, appropriate management level. You have to get there, and then at that point, you could use a little bit more of fertility control to try and manage the growth rate of these herds. But if you can't get down to that lower end of AML, you're going to be faced with this on an annual,
It's a revolving door. I mean, they're prolific. They reproduce. I mean, faster you can keep up.
You have drought, and then you have feral horses.
Yeah. How much coordination do you do with the BLM about, I mean, what's your feedback to them as far as feral horse populations and burro populations?
Well, you know, we report to them on, you know, the numbers we see, the damage we see, mm-hmm. things like that. But, you know, and honestly, their hands are pretty much tied because it comes from Congress mm-hmm. that, you know, there's only so much money. And a lot of those horses are in long-term holding,
mm-hmm.
and that's using up the bulk of the budget for that whole program.
What was it, $93 million, $125 million? Yeah, just for feeding horses that are in captivity, that mm-hmm. are, you know, pulled off. And then, yeah, we had Jenny on. She came down. She was, I don't know if you guys know, she worked for the BLM, the Wild Horse and Burro Program. She came to, 2 hours with us and talked, I mean, just absolutely spit facts on mm-hmm. on horses. And, it's pretty... I wish I could be optimistic, but I'm pretty pessimistic about where it's at. And really the reality is I just, in order to get something done, you're going to have to have a change in Congress, right? You're going to have to adjust the act. So the Wild Horse and Burro Act essentially is going to have to be addressed and changed. And I don't really see any solution other than lethal removal, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't know where that's going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in Northern Nevada, Winnemucca, Nevada, and I'm old enough at this point where I do remember I was looking at wild horses before the Wild Horse and Burro Act mm-hmm. came into place. And I remember thinking, you know, wow, wild horses, they're awesome. Mm-hmm. But there was few of them. There wasn't so many. And you know, I still think horses are a neat animal. Sure. It's just the number. And when you get to such a high number of horses, in my opinion, they lose what's special about them. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you know, you walked outside and there was bighorn sheep everywhere, you'd kind of get tired of it. I mean, as awesome as bighorn sheep are.
Which might take a while.
But it's just the, you know, it's just the density of them. Yeah. And the fact that, you know, I mean, if bighorns were like that, we could do something about it.
Yeah.
We could increase tax.
And you would.
And
any other species on the planet,
we'd be happy to.
We'd like them managed
properly. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's probably the biggest challenge is that the number of horses on the landscape is higher than what most of the scientists think is appropriate. And uh-huh. so it does bring some challenges with it.
And I was hiking this last weekend up in Mount Charleston. And I don't know if you saw on the news, but I was up there. There was a bunch of feral horses down below as we drove back, and everyone was stopped looking at them or whatever. And then I saw on the news, my girlfriend texted me. It was on something on Instagram. Actually, a kid got kicked somewhere, but by a feral horse.
Mm.
Obviously, people are idiots, but like, you know.
Trying to get a picture with
a feral horse. And like, I'm seeing more and more in that area. Obviously, there's more and more burros around here and stuff like that too. But it's just like really interesting that that's becoming a thing now where people stopping and looking at all these feral horses along the highway, and then a kid gets hit or mm-hmm. kicked by one. So, yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that you know we're warmer, we're drier, the number of feral horses and burros in the landscape is just compounding. It's just another issue that native wildlife ungulates have to compete with, in essence. And I don't know. This is a hard one because this is like one of those issues when I look at it. To me, it seems fairly simple. It's like the solution seems fairly simple. It's like I just said, any other species that a state agency manages, like yourselves, we would deal with this issue, right? And because there is this act that says you can't, and they keep, you know, it keeps being litigated anytime they make a change to it, you can't lethally remove them, which in my mind is like, it's got to be the answer. You have to get that population to like a sustainable level. And I don't know. I would like to think that maybe this administration is the best case scenario that we might ever have to actually be able to address this thing. I don't have to encourage you guys. I'm sure you've talked to, you know, commissioners and your governor and everything else, and just everybody put pressure on your representatives because it's not good. And you know what else is interesting is Jenny asked Brady and I, she said, if you really want to see something, tune into this meeting that I'm going to tomorrow. So cool. Brady and I jumped online and we watched this meeting that she was going to, and it was basically on a fence building project for a wetland there in northern Nevada, where they're trying to fence a riparian area to keep the wild horses out. And she went to speak in favor of it, and basically saying that the native, you know, wildlife species, the birds, migratory species are basically declining to a point where there just aren't that many at all. And she said, tune in, just see what these people are like, that give feedback. And I was blown away.
It was crazy.
People are very passionate about horses.
Mm-hmm. There's a fist fight.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Jumped on.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe it, but yeah, I mean, this is a very passionate crowd, and I get it. I understand. I'm with you. I think horses are cool, but not at the level that they're at.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you guys are in a tough spot. Yeah. I just ran it for 20 minutes to tell you guys something you already know. But, yeah. I mean, I just would encourage everybody. Just let's put some pressure. It's like something's got to happen. Uh-huh. Yeah. If I go back to mule deer real quick, what are your current statewide population estimate for mule deer?
We're right around 65,000 mule deer. That's the estimate currently. But looking at recruitment, we'll probably expand that number, that estimate this year coming up.
Okay.
So, and I've talked to you a bit about this, our fall surveys. Tell me, did we see the highest recruitment numbers for fall surveys in 25 years?
Yeah, in a lot of areas.
So fawn ratios, that's good. Fawn ratios are looking good.
Could I ask you about buck to doe ratios and what you
get?
I am from Cedar City. This is it's in my blood. I have to ask about buck to doe ratios. Uh-huh. What do you guys manage to and why?
30.
30.
We manage to 30
across the state.
Yep.
Okay. Well, in most of our units, we do have some alternative units that are 35.
Okay.
And then, yeah, just based off recent tag allocations.
Yeah, we're above that in a lot of units currently.
Yeah, and you know, so we're supposed to manage for 30 in our standard units and 35 in our alternative units. And this is where the county advisory boards come in, because we can make a recommendation and they might say, oh, we think that's too many tags. And so the Wildlife Commission might agree with us and they might agree with them. I've grown up in this system and I still like it. I still like it even when I don't agree with different people and I think we should have more tags, but it allows that public input to manage wildlife. And we provide the science and we say this is the number you could safely go to, but there's social reasons that people don't want to, and sometimes they want, you know, the thought is that higher buck ratios mean more big bucks, and in general I would say that that's probably true, but it's not always true, because if you think about it, when you have high buck ratios at the time of year when bucks are growing their antlers, they're in the buck pastures and they're competing with one another. And so sometimes when you have those really high buck ratios, you end up with a lot of cookie cutter bucks and not so many exceptional bucks. So I'm not saying that it sure works that way all the time, but after having seen some of these really, really high densities of bucks in the summer, I do think in those years that we've had the really hard winters and you've seen, you know, some big drop offs where we did see lower numbers of bucks, lower numbers of deer on the landscape, but lower numbers of bucks, those are tend to be the years that we see the most bucks go into the book. Record book. So I don't know if that's true, but it's just a thought.
Did you follow along with Utah's new mule deer plan and the lowering of, you know, buck to doe ratios? They're talking basically taking units from general season units from like 18 to 21, 22 to 15 to 17. And they're kind of doing it on the backs of some research that was done through BYU. Basically it's kind of alluding to the fact that a lower buck to doe ratio has an impact on herd production, increasing the overall herd as a whole. I don't know if you followed along with that, but it's been interesting living where I live, because it's such a social construct, right? It's like, what do people want in a hunt more than it is actually, you know, maybe the biology. You know, people want to see bucks, they want a chance to hunt bucks, and then Utah right now is kind of going through this debate of like, what is it that we want, you know? And there's a lot of people that are up in arms, you know, they're really upset that a buck to doe ratio might be 15 per 100. And then on the flip side of it, you've got, you know, some biologists and science and, you know, a plan that I was a part of the committee actually that it came out of, essentially saying, we think we can increase these herds by lowering the buck to doe ratio, which seems so counterintuitive, right? Any thoughts? What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I would just say, and you can jump in here too, Joe, but yeah, it's just like we're talking about with the Muddy Mountain sheep. If you're reducing the amount of competition for forage on the landscape, obviously you're not changing the female segment of the population, so you're allowing that portion of the population to probably improve their quality. And so, yeah, it stands to reason that you might have more productivity there, better recruitment by having fewer bucks on the landscape.
No, people aren't lining up though to lower your buck to doe ratio.
I don't think so.
No, surprisingly enough.
Yeah, so we keep lifting it.
I may be a little biased because I've harvested two of the biggest bucks I've ever killed in my life in Pine Valley over the last 3 years. Man,
you have to talk to Brady.
But then when you think about that, the population size or the population estimate, you're talking, what, 17, 18,000 deer, correct me? Mm-hmm. Whereas, what's our largest population estimate? What's Area 10 at right now?
8,000, 9,000 deer.
Gotcha.
You're kind of comparing apples and oranges when you look at that density aspect, because nobody's going to go across and look at the browse component of Utah and say Nevada's better than this. It's just not.
Yep.
And so that
we say the same thing about Colorado.
Yeah. So
I mean,
yeah.
Being from Utah, right. I look at Colorado and I'm like, you got habitat everywhere.
Yeah. So you go to their winter range and then it's a little different story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So summer range for days.
Yeah.
So I guess where I was going with that is biologically, you could obviously have a much slower buck to doe ratio and still not see an effect on recruitment. But maybe in an area where you do have densities that high, you would reduce that competition. You may see it a lot more than us, maybe in Nevada.
Yeah, good point. We're gonna find out. We'll see. We'll report back.
Are we gonna reach that threshold?
If we ever get there, because it's like you're saying, there's so much social science that goes into hunting tags and recommendations. You know, a lot of it is, you know, the science, the biologists, yourselves. You'll make a recommendation based on science, based on biology, and then you'll have a public that'll come back and say, yeah, we kind of want this, and we want this for our hunt, you know? It's a tough job. You guys have to navigate it's a pretty windy road to try to figure out how to get to where we all want to go. Yeah. Maybe talk to me about quotas and how you look at non-residents and your draw. You know, I'm a non-resident. I apply in Nevada. I get 5 choices, just as your residents do. You guys consider all 5 of my choices before moving to the next applicant. So in essence, I get to apply for 5 hunts. I could draw any of my hunts once my application is considered. It's hard to draw a tag for me as a non-resident. Do you see that system lasting? Do you look at maybe potentially changing that system to maybe 1 choice or 2 choice to maybe increase my odds, because then it would make me pick, right? Like the hunt that I really want. And I'm borrowing this from, you guys probably know from Jason and Adam up at Epic. I know those guys have been, you know, I've been talking to those guys, and I listened to recently, they kind of brought this up, and it just, you know, put a grain of salt in the back of my mind. And I figured since you guys were here, I'd ask you.
I wish I had some of the details of it. We actually went and looked into this last year, as I believe as part of the TAC committee, which is the tag allocation and hunt committee. And they requested some of that information, and we did a pretty deep dive on it. And I can't remember all the details of it, but we can get it to you, or we can provide you. I think it was at the commission meeting or where we provided the information, but it was actually really compelling. We had a couple of wildlife commissioners that were dead set that that's what we should do until we showed them the statistics. And they said, oh no, this would not be good to change. And so I don't know if you can remember any of the details of it, but
just seems to me like maybe it was the first 2 or first 3 choices, and then you get much further back beyond that, and it just dropped so far off the end of the table that we thought, well, why exclude the 4th and 5th choice? You know, if it wasn't really, you might get a guy that, you know, maybe he's got 10 points, then for a mule deer tag, yeah, then there's a reasonable expectation that you might draw his 4th or 5th choice, but it wasn't a large proportion at all.
Yeah, I mean, I often wonder, you know, it's because it's the business that we live in. You know, how do you increase somebody's odds, essentially? And I'd listened to those guys, and I thought about it a little bit, and I wondered if that would be something feasible. You know, you would make people essentially apply for the hunt that they really want versus people applying for the best of the best. I mean, if you figure everybody's application that applies in the state of Nevada, most people are probably putting that 241, 245 tag as their first choice, you know? And then they're kind of staggering it down to some hunt that they would live with. And I often wonder, like, what would happen if you only gave somebody 1 choice or 2 choices and you only considered those? You would make people really pick, like, am I an opportunity guy, or am I a guy that really only wants to hunt the best of the best?
Yeah, and I believe, you know, so I kind of nerded out on this at one point, but if I remember correctly, we looked at a lot of the people that had the highest number of bonus points. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say this with respect to sheep. I want to say that out of, you know, I don't know how many of those people there were, but there was something like 283 people if they had chosen, made all five choices, they would have drawn a tag. Absolutely 100% mm-hmm. would have drawn a tag somewhere in the previous few years. Now, a lot of people are applying for
263.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm no different. I apply for the premium areas. I don't always put five choices, but that's my choice. Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to hunt, California Bighorn. Mm-hmm. I believe I have 33 bonus points for California Bighorn, and I've been applying for one of the areas. It's no longer the best area in the state, mm-hmm. But it's meaningful to me, and so I keep applying for it. And you know, people have different reasons for choosing the areas that they choose. There's people that Lincoln County, they want to hunt Lincoln County, and mm-hmm. and I'm, since I spent so much time in Lincoln County, I keep applying down there. And I've hunted all over the state, but when I am making my choice, it's like I want to hunt in that spot. I don't mm-hmm. I really don't care, you know. I want to have the opportunity to harvest the animal that I'm looking for, and I could do that in almost any area in the state. I truly believe. I think we have quality animals in every part of the state, but some of them I don't know them as well, mm-hmm. and I'm just less comfortable going there. So sure. I'm kind of a creature of habit, and it's like going into a restaurant and I, you know, I think, club sandwich, I ordered it again. So, you know, I'm kind of a creature of habit. So I pick those areas, but they're, again, getting back to that bonus point and choice thing. There are, I believe it was something like 280 people that would have drawn some sheep tag if they had applied for it.
Yeah. I think that's fine. I'm kind of on the fence about it, whether you limit, if you reduce the number of choices, which I think in essence would open up some opportunities for some of the, you know, not the premier units, right? Because I think you'd have some people that are like, this is the most important hunt, especially as a non-resident. Like if I'm going to travel to Nevada, it would really make me think, like, what kind of experience do I want to have? So I like kind of the idea of reducing the number of choices available to people, because I think it would make people really pick the hunt that they want. Mm-hmm. And it would maybe leave open some better odds for some of those opportunity style hunts that maybe aren't the best of the best. And then I also go back the other way. You don't think so?
Well, because you could increase the chance of having more tags available then in the second draw, which then would put more pressure on that, because then everyone could then apply for them again. So sure. You double the...
Yeah, it's not perfect. I'm just thinking it through. Yeah.
If you're a primitive weapon hunter, mm-hmm. Muzzleloader or archery, then it probably would benefit you the most to have
and
that.
And I am. That's probably why I thought... That's probably why I was driving around today. I was like, hey, I got a pitch for these guys. I also, like I said, I'm on the fence a little bit too, because it is nice. It is fun to throw in your five choices, you know, and swing for the fences essentially on your first couple choices, and then something that I would live with and I would go out and have a good hunt. So I was just curious as to, how often do they visit that, the draws? Do you guys go through that?
We really did a deep dive this last year.
Gotcha.
And honestly, you mentioned Jason and Adam, and that kind of came from them, because
sure.
I took that and I said, you know, I made that into one of the topics that we talked about. And so we really did look into it. And as we provided the information, the commission chose not to go that direction. Mm-hmm. But I will get that information for you, and I will send it to you. And
I probably should send it to. I'd like to know the reasons why.
I probably should send it to the Epic Boys too, because they're probably pretty interested.
I'll be in touch with them and say.
What about Nevada's first come first serve? Does that get looked at often? Or what reason I'm bringing it up? I wonder if there's any way you could look at harvest stats on first comes first serve tags compared to people drew it normally, because I hear I'm just bringing stuff up that I hear people grumble about a lot. So like, oh, maybe I'll touch on the podcast that people who turn back a tag and then that person who picks it up on first come first serve is more apt to probably kill any sort of, I'm just speaking deer, because like, well, I burned my points. Now I definitely have to go on this hunt and I'm not going to walk away without killing some because I have 6 points or whatever for a resident. So they end up just shooting any deer. And there's a lot of, I'm not going to say, like just a lot of people in general who are thinking that the first come first serve tags are making more people kill deer in Nevada that probably would maybe not if they just drew it normally and didn't have to turn it back, because then they'd be apt to maybe hold out a little bit. So I don't know if there's a way to look at, like, if harvest is increasing on some of these deer tags.
We could certainly look at it. I don't know that we've actually separated that out.
I wouldn't think so, but
We kind of look at it holistically. So we look at, you know, the entire, you know, there's 50 tags and we have, you know, 45% success. Mm-hmm. And they just get included in that. But we could certainly separate that out and take a look at it. I suspect you're probably right. The people that apply for or pick up the first come first serve tags, they are the ones that are willing to hunt just about anywhere and they want to kill an animal.
Yeah, especially the people too might be picking them up multiple years. Like, I have zero anyway. I'm gonna have zero next year because I'm picking one up. So mm-hmm. I'm gonna keep, you know, shooting whatever because mm-hmm. I can keep picking up a tag slightly on the first come first, which is a cool opportunity if people want to do that too. I'm not trying to take the opportunity away from it. It's an awesome opportunity, but just thoughts I've heard people talk about.
Yeah, got me thinking about. There's a couple of things I gotta kind of dive into it.
Some homework.
Try to figure out.
In the few units I have looked at, though, when you think of the proportion of tags going first come first serve, I don't know if it's actually going to change that harvest statistic of the entire unit mm-hmm. much.
Yeah, no.
You may have a couple other bucks that maybe were younger age class harvested, but I don't think it's going to change
percentage
the overall
points, maybe
success much.
Yeah. When you guys set quotas for. Look, I want to get into elk a little bit, but when you set quotas for mule deer, do you base that on buck to doe ratio? Does harvest success come into that at all? Mm-hmm. Are you managing to a certain percentage of harvest success? Like, you want to see a certain percentage of harvest success, or is it purely like a buck to doe ratio? This is what we want it to be, and we issue tags based on that.
Well, it's kind of complicated.
Sure.
So we have population models, and okay. we do look at harvest success. But we have in our guidelines, we have three schemes for mule deer. And there's the standard, which is 30 bucks per 100 does. There's the alternative, which is the 35 bucks. And then there's non-standard. And that's based on harvest success. And that's usually our low density areas where we don't even survey them because it wouldn't. Statistically, we couldn't pick up enough deer to make a model run.
Quality
so
sample.
We put out tags, and then, you know, if we see a really high success, you know, we can increase tags by a few the next year and see if it stays the same or if it drops, you know, so we adjust them that way. And
gotcha.
But with respect to our population models, we do put the harvest success in there and it helps run the model, but just
sure.
You know, to
but you're not managing for like, we want to see this much harvest success, and if it's lower the next year, maybe we'll up tags. It's probably more a factor of population dynamics, right? Buck to doe ratios, just the number of deer in general.
Yeah, generally that's how it works. Okay. But you know, there are times that we're looking at harvest success and you know, it's dropping off, even though the population stays high. Mm-hmm. We could adjust tags, you know, based on harvest success.
Do you manage to age class or score any of your deer units? Not for deer.
No, some units we do look at the 4-point or better metric on the alternative hunts or mm-hmm. the alternative hunt, both alternative hunt structures, the one with the 35 bucks per 100 does, and then the non-standard where we just have success metrics in some units. We will look at that quality metric as
gotcha.
Well.
Gotcha. How do you address elk? Because you've got... I would argue that Nevada probably has, in terms of trophy potential, it's probably, I would say it's probably, would you say it's top state right now?
I mean,
I would say it's top three.
Yeah. The hunts I've been on, my gosh, there's a lot of bulls in the landscape, and it's so fun. It's the funnest thing ever. It's just, I don't know, it's just amazing opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I bring it up because I know Utah, they managed to an age class. Right, so they're trying to hit you know, maybe 6.5 to 7.5 year old bulls on any given unit. They have people submit teeth. How do you guys approach elk management in terms of quotas and bull to cow ratios and that kind of thing?
Well, so we've looked at teeth over the year and years, and I'll let these guys speak to this too. But right now, I think we look at main beam length.
Yeah.
And if it's, you know, over 50 inches, you know, some percentage, we can, you know, that's, we're looking at trying to find the sweet spot there. And so I don't know if you guys can speak to more of it.
30%?
Yeah. Oh, it's 25% to 35%. We look for that range of the 50-inch main beam. And then based off the tooth data that we've sent over the years, that correlates with about an 8-year-old bull mm-hmm. on the landscape. So if you look at our harvest data for elk, you look at that 6-pointer better metric, I mean, you're talking 60-70% in a lot of, maybe mm-hmm. even 80% in a lot of units. It's, we take all those metrics, but really, you know, you mentioned bull to cow ratio. So when we conduct our aerial surveys for elk, it's normally the winter months. It's not during the rut period. So you're not, that bull to cow ratio you observe on survey really isn't driving the bus. It's that cow to calf ratio. Mm-hmm. And then that sees how your population trend is going through time. And then you factor in those harvest statistics, survival data into that model that Mike alluded to a little earlier.
Gotcha.
Yeah, our bull ratios, if you look at it 20 years ago, was a little, quite a bit different than it is today. We were usually somewhere in the realm of 16 to 40 bulls per 100 cows. Now we're in a lot of units, we're north of 60. In a lot of the units, and the age class has climbed from about 5 to just over 6 in that time frame as well.
I will say that I wish you guys, or I wish other states could look at what Nevada does with harvest reporting, and we can make that mandatory everywhere else. I think you guys do a very, very good job. I love looking at main beam length, antelope horn length, like all this data is super cool, and you make it mandatory. Like, make it mandatory, and you add a fee on top of it. Because speaking of my brother, I went into his account the other day and realized he didn't do it. He had to pay a $50 fee. And I was like, ooh, that sucks for you, Bryce. But you forgot to do that. But it's like, it's cool you guys collect that data and then can use it. And then me as a hunter, I geek out on that data too. And like, you know, hunt all these other states that sometimes don't even have mandatory harvest reporting. Mm-hmm. I get a random phone call at some random time, and I miss it all the time, and they never call me back. Or I've had the most premium deer tag in a certain state before, and they never called me for my harvest data. You think you want to know if I killed or not, so you can manage the herd better and distribute tags. But like, Nevada does such a great job. I wish more states actually gave that cool data, because actually really, like, you look at the sheep data too. I got the sheep data. Like, even though I'm probably never going to draw a sheep tag, like, I nerd on that data. It's cool to see.
Yeah. The tables in the back of that big game status book are pretty valuable. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course that's available on our website. I don't know how many people look at it, but obviously mm-hmm. guys like you.
Downloader. I have it on my phone and my computer. That's when I'm bored.
Look at the IP address and he's the highest.
Yeah. North of 60 bulls per 100 cows.
In some herd units, yeah.
Are those populations growing still? Or are they pretty stable?
They ebb and flow with the conditions of the landscape. Mm-hmm. I would say most of them are probably pretty stable right now, but we get the right conditions, they could increase.
Gotcha. I guess, and I think you were probably about to speak to this as well, you know, we're going to be discussing the elk management plan at the commission meeting over the next couple of days. And then associated with that elk management plan is subplans for a lot of these different hunt units or mm-hmm. areas. So we had elk populations, I would say, and you guys would probably agree, you know, 10 years, quite a bit higher than they are right now, because we're required to manage those elk numbers at that plan.
What's your statewide quota for elk? Do you know?
Well, I don't know that it's put that way. All the different sub plans have different population objectives.
Sure.
There's one that's managed on resource condition, not necessarily by numbers, but by you know, how much forage is being consumed or is available. Most of the other plans have managed for a number. And, you know, it makes it a bit easier for us to set quotas on those, because, you know, we say, well, we're 500 over where we're supposed to be, so we got to bring some numbers down. And I mean, there's times that people don't want to do that, but, you know, we're committed to managing to the numbers that we said we would.
Sure.
So that it does make it a bit easier for us to manage, you mm-hmm. know, for elk.
And I guess one quick add-on, that is why you would see an increase in that bull ratio as well, because we did have to hammer the cow so hard. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like when you think of the 1-to-1 ewe to ram ratio in the muddies, we're constantly having to either move ewes out of the population or harvest them to keep it below that threshold. So that does influence that ratio through time.
Gotcha. Are most of your elk herds at objective? Would you say mm-hmm. pretty yeah, close to objective?
I think we have one that's over.
If it might, one, it might two. Be none. Yeah.
What's that?
One, maybe two that's over.
Yeah, one I or think. Two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So almost all of them are you know within the constraints that gotcha. They're supposed to be.
What? Do you have a question? I was going to just ask you, as a whole, how would you describe Nevada in terms of opportunity? And like, how would you say Nevada is managed for hunting in general? Should a non-resident consider applying in Nevada? And if so, why?
I'm going to speak from a lot of experience as a non-person who applies in about every Western state.
Okay.
My dad started putting me in when I was 10. That's when I harvested my first deer in Arizona. And it's, you at least have a chance here.
Sure.
There's a lot of states like where I can apply for a sheep tag in a certain state, and if I don't do my homework, I don't even have a chance at drawing it, even with 25 bonus points. So I think... And I know a lot of people as non-residents who have drawn tags and they have a great experience. And I think you at least have a chance based off our system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I know applying for some of the more quality units in Utah or even in Wyoming these days, you kind of know going in that you're not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. So I just wait and buy the bonus point in the summertime, and it's like, that's a... kind of a tough to think of thought, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a downer, but then you think, maybe I'll just go upland game hunting in Nevada for the year. So yeah. It doesn't really bother me like it used to. But we're always a state that's going to be more conservative because we just have fewer resources than a lot of other states. So we almost by de facto have to manage to that mm-hmm. metric, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But like Joe said, at least within our draw system, it might be like you said earlier, Brady, it might be 0.9%.
Yeah. And somebody's got to draw the tag. Three bonus points when he drew.
Yeah, it was Let's like, it was three. It was, I think it was three or four.
That was a 1-2-1 bull elk tag.
Yeah, okay. It was pretty wild.
Just putting you on the spot.
I mean, he did kill the biggest bull of his life and probably the biggest bull he ever will. So it was like, it is worth, I think, applying and waiting. Well, I do my whole family for it.
I guess that would be the plug that I would put is it's difficult to draw a tag in Nevada, but if you do draw a tag in Nevada, you stand a chance of harvesting a truly special animal. And you know, and they're not everywhere, but you should be able to at least see and have a chance to harvest a really, you know, a mature older age class animal.
Yeah, and I think it's just a fun hunt too. Like I took my dad. You know, my brother there, myself, I had a camera guy there. Like the amount of bulls that my dad even got to see at his age, like, is pretty cool too. Like to be able to take someone out there and show them, okay, this is, you know, my home state. This is what we have to offer. Like, look at all these bulls. He's like, I can't believe we're passing up this bull. He's like, I would shop this in any other state right now. Like, what are we doing? Are we like trying to convince my brother to shoot? I'm sometimes convincing my brother to try to shoot a bull. He's like, no, we're going to keep holding out. Like, that's what makes Nevada special. You literally can hold out every single day and eventually, you know, it could work out like it did for him, but it's a sweet opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've told people again, like, it's kind of a cost benefit. I think you nailed it. If you draw a tag in Nevada, you're in for a pretty good experience. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll have the opportunity to see a decent number of animals. You probably have the chance to hunt a buck or a bull that is a great animal. Like I said, I think arguably you probably have one of the best resources in the world for elk. And I think to me, it's that chance, right? I think I did a podcast with some guys yesterday morning, from Minnesota, whitetail hunters. And so they wanted to just talk Western game hunting and kind of compare and contrast to whitetail hunting. And, when I was talking to those guys, I don't gamble. Like, I don't go to the casinos down here. I don't play slots. But this time of year, for me, it's like my own little gamble, right? Like, I'm going to take my $160 and, you know, my application fees to you guys for each and every species, and then in every other state as well. And that's like my own little way of gambling. And it's fun. It's just fun to, it's fun to have a chance. I mean, every year I don't expect to draw in Nevada, but when, you know, lightning strikes and I do, it's been great experiences, and it's just a fun game to play. And then again, you know, Lorenzo always goes back to saying, you know, you're donating essentially to conservation by buying a license, right? It goes back into funds that helps you guys do, you know, good things for wildlife in general, whether or not I get to hunt it or not. So I think, I guess my case would be, I do think Nevada is worth applying. It's like that dream state, especially if you're an elk nut like I am. Deer are cool, but elk are way cooler. And I don't know how many points I'm sitting on, probably 14 or 15, but I just hope that one of these days I get lucky and I get that experience, you know. So yeah, that would be my plea to people, is take a hard look at Nevada. I think it's definitely worth applying for.
I don't know if I probably should know the answer to this, but do we know how states started getting to that 90-10 number and why it became such a, like, a lot of other states do 90-10 as well, for resident, non-resident breakdown?
Yeah, so there was actually a lawsuit. I believe it was around 2002, somewhere in there, where there was a non-resident guide that was basically suing the state of Nevada to go to a 50-50 for resident, non-resident. And our commission at that time took action to create the 90-10 split. And as you can imagine, you know, the resident hunters weren't thrilled to hear that, you know, their tags could go 50% to non-residents. But anyway, they put that in place at that time. And I think a lot of other states are, you know, sort of similar. I don't know if they're, you know, I mean, it's different all across the board. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but with the limited resource that we have in Nevada, you know, because a lot of our residents go years without drawing tags. Mm-hmm. And so the 90-10 split, I think, is fair. You know, and like I said, we love our non-residents because, mm-hmm. You know, they do pay a fair share of the money that comes into us, mm-hmm. license and tag fees and applications. So we truly appreciate it. And I would encourage people to apply, not for the money part, but for the experience.
Yeah, that was the reason I started applying in Nevada back in the day when I was a non-resident. I actually drew a deer tag as a non-resident before, because I wanted to, you know, everyone always talked about Nevada, how cool it was to hunt. I wanted to chase velvet bucks with my bow. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's a great season days, you know?
Yeah.
Kill buck fourth day of the seasons. Prime velvet.
You got the best season days.
Best season days for deer.
For velvet muleys, yeah. For a bow hunter. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else? Anything else you wanted to ask?
No.
Anything else you guys had on your agenda that you thought you wanted to address or talk about or get out to the public that we can help you with?
I think we covered a lot there.
We covered a lot. I don't think we had anything else that we truly wanted to cover.
Gotcha.
You know, we would like to have you guys on our podcast at some point.
Love to.
I think that would be good. We have a couple of folks that do, you know, do our own podcast, and we'd love to have you guys.
Yeah, we'd love to. Mm-hmm.
So. Happy.
Yeah, I mean, I would just conclude by saying I genuinely appreciate what you guys do for wildlife and for, you know, us as hunters and the state of Nevada and as a non-resident. I look at Nevada as this, you know, pillar. Like, should I draw this tag? You know, it's a hope for me every single year when I apply. And I've worked for state agencies. I know it can seem at times like a pretty thankless job. It can seem like, you know, nobody's on your side. And I've been there. And so I just wanted to say I genuinely appreciate what you do. And I know that you do it for the love of the resource. And I appreciate what you guys do. And thanks for coming by today.
You bet. We appreciate it. And we appreciate the partnership with you guys. Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, you guys, the dream tag, mm-hmm. you know, that you guys do a lot of work on that. And, you know, you guys get the word out for us. So appreciate the partnership.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do so.
I know you guys have been working with our Con Ed division a lot. Come out on any project. We're going to.
That'd be fun.
We get up together, Joe.
Might be the only wild sheep I ever actually catch.
We'll let you name it and everything before it goes on the trailer.
The last 2 weeks in June will be pretty busy, okay. So you'll have at least 14 days or 10 days to
do it.
Okay, yeah, we'll do it. Yeah, my shorts. All right, thanks, guys.
Yep,
thank you. Thanks.